In 2011, Americans took in five times as much information every day as they did in 1986, the equivalent of 175 newspapers. During our leisure time every day, each of us processes 34 gigabytes or 100,000 words, and that's not even counting our work. The information age is perhaps drowning us in a deluge of data, even while we're expected to make more and faster decisions than ever before. Enter now neuroscientist Daniel Levitin, the best-selling author of This Is Your Brain on Music. His new book is The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Daniel Levitin to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Nice to be here, Joe.
What brought you to this idea of looking to organize the mind?
Well, I've always been interested in how we organize things. And then I realized that as neuroscientists, we know a lot about how the brain works, about why we pay attention to some things and not others, about why we remember some things better than others. All knowledge that we've acquired as a field in the last 10 or 20 years that hasn't really trickled down to the average person. And I think that all of us can use this information to better organize our time, our decision-making, our homes, and our workplaces.
And in that organization, what are the challenges when it comes to this, as you put it in the subtitle of the book, this information overload?
Well, the challenges are to realize that there's an illusion going on where we think that we have to be working and engaged every possible minute. And I say it's an illusion because there's actually a loss of productivity. Take overtime. Most of us, many of us anyway, work more than the 40 hours a week, at least if not at our jobs, at other things. We're pushing all the time. And the research shows that for every hour you work after 40, you only get 20 to 30 minutes worth of actual work done. So there's really this point of diminishing returns.
So what sets that up, and then how ultimately do we go to change that?
I think we have to give ourselves permission to do things that seem perfectly obvious, but that we don't do. We need to take breaks. We need to take naps for those of us who can take naps. They're tremendously restorative, these breaks and naps. Most of us in our jobs these days, with all of the constant demands, not just our jobs, but our lives, our active lives, we're functioning more like air traffic controllers with all these things hitting us at once from all directions. And, you know, it turns out if you're an air traffic controller, there are laws. You're not allowed to work more than 45 minutes or an hour at a time without taking a 15 to 30 minute break. And those breaks are very important for the brain to reset itself. They're also not coincidentally the time when we can be the most creative. If you're just sitting around doing nothing and daydreaming, it does kind of hit the reset button in the brain. And often we find that people are coming up with their most creative ideas during those periods of rest.
You make the point in the book that disrupting sleep even two or three days after an experience can disrupt your memory for months, even years.
Yeah, it turns out that having good sleep hygiene is very important for productivity and for mental health, physical health, and for happiness. And as you say, there's research that shows that one all-nighter or one night of bad sleep can interfere with memory consolidation for months or years. What we now know about sleep is that, among other things, to biologically restore the brain, it's when memory consolidation occurs. That is, actually getting a memory into your brain to be stored for later retrieval. That all happens while we're asleep. And if you disrupt the sleep, the memory doesn't get in there at all, or it gets in there in a way that you can't get it back.
You say in the book that that when we multitask, that that is bad, because what happens is the information, there's so much going in that it goes to the wrong part of the brain. So where does it go, and why is that a bad thing?
When we're really trying to get something done, we're using a part of the brain called the central executive. We're paying attention. We're applying sustained thought to the problem in front of us, or the thing we're making, or the thing we're doing. And from that sustained attention comes great things. It's sustained attention built the pyramids and taught us to decode the human genome. We discovered penicillin. All of this comes from sustained attention. Multitasking is a myth. We don't actually multitask. Instead, what we do is we shift rapidly from one thing to another, never allowing our thoughts to settle into any one thing. So when we say that it goes to the wrong part of the brain, when you're multitasking, it's activating a pleasure circuit in the limbic system of the brain that keeps making you feel like you're getting things done and giving you the pleasure of engagement. But according to all the available evidence, you're not actually getting very much done at all.
You're a lot less productive.
Yeah.
I'm pleased to report that in the book you say that it's okay to have a junk drawer. That's a good thing.
Yes. The junk drawer is kind of a crowning achievement of human cognition if you think about it in terms of cognitive flexibility. What it says is that there's this whole class of stuff that I'm classifying together. I'm categorizing it as stuff that I don't know what to do with. And the way the human categorization system works is fascinating, and I could talk about that for hours. But I think one of the main things it says is that if you throw something in the junk drawer, as long as your junk drawer doesn't become hugely overloaded, it's an act of cognitive efficiency. You've got some little thing in your hand. You're not sure where it goes. There's probably a better place to put it. But for now, you're just going to put it in the junk drawer and get on with your life and not allow it to distract you. That's part of being organized, too.
You divide this up in the book about organizing our time, organizing our home, organizing ourselves. So there are different components to this. And ultimately, I'm curious as to, are the tenets of organization fairly firm that they hold over into many different disciplines? So the way that I organize my home is very similar to the way that I can organize my mind.
I think that's true, Joe, but it doesn't have to be. So some people, I'm one of them. I have a system at my office where everything is in files and my desk is clear. But at home, I tend to make piles because I work better that way. And I think these different styles apply to different people in different situations. At my office, I have a number of papers that, you know, because I run a laboratory and I'm teaching students and I'm designing curricula, everything has to be in file folders because other people need to find these things. But at home, when it's just me, I can go ahead and make piles because I know where everything is and I'm the only one that needs to know.
But it's still organization, and it's ultimately knowing where something is when you want to retrieve it.
Right. That's part of the key, knowing where something is and setting up systems where you try to plan for the future of where will I look for this? If I forgot where I put it, where will I look for it? Where is a place I can put it that is logical so that I'll be able to find it again?
The name of the book is The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. It is published by Dutton. Daniel Levitin, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. I do appreciate it.
My pleasure, Joe.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. The book is published by Dutton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.